Welcome back to PMP. We have at PMPnetwork.com right now a great guest. You probably remember her as someone who had 8 charted singles, 5 of them top 30 hits from 1961 to 1965. Joining us right now is Dee Dee Phelps. You might know her better from Dee Dee, Dicka, and Dee Dee, a group that had a number of hits, and we're going to talk to her about them right now. How are you?
I'm good. How are you today?
I'm doing great, thanks.
Excellent. Good.
I noticed that Dick St. John wrote most of the songs, although a few of them you co-wrote with him.
He did. He was really a prolific songwriter, and he wrote all different styles. He wrote rock. He wrote ballads. He wrote Tell Me and The Mountainside, Tell Me, Young and in Love, and then he didn't write Turn Around a Dash on Steel.
Now, tell us a little bit about, you guys met actually when you were really young, right?
We met in junior high school, and we didn't see each other through high school because I moved to a different area, and I went to another school. But we were reunited in my first year of college, and I was working in a candy store.
I need to have you speak up a little bit, okay?
Yeah, I was working in a candy store, and Dick got a job there as a box boy, and we both discovered that we both wrote songs, so we started working together, and we came up with the first song we ever recorded, which was The Flip Side of the Mountains High, and it was the song everyone thought was going to be the hit. It was a ballad, a very pretty song, and a lot of energy was put into the strings and creating this wonderful song, and then they had to throw something on the back, so they put The Mountains High in the back. They didn't really spend much time recording it either. It was kind of a, we went into kind of a real funky studio for that one.
I Want Someone is the song you were talking about, right?
I Want Someone, right. That was the song that they thought was going to be, that was the side they were going to promote. That was the A side of their record.
Hmm. Yeah, we should tell people who are young and don't remember things like this that years ago they had an A side and a B side. The A side was the one that the record company usually would promote. The B side would just be stuck on there for just to fill up space. But many times, though, the DJs would turn it over and the B-side would become the big hit.
That's right. And of course, in those days, we're talking about 45 RPM records, which were made out of vinyl. And they were sort of the size. They were a little bit larger than your basic CD today. But unlike the CD, which you never flip over, these did have, as you mentioned, they had two sides to them. And usually they had an idea. They were going to promote the A-side, and they figured that was the one, whatever they were trying to, whatever their belief was, that which was the best song, they would go with that one and promote it. And the other one was anything. They'd throw anything on the back because no one ever flipped it over. In our case, there was a disc jockey in San Francisco named Bob Mitchell on KYA, and he had a huge following, and he was not paying attention one day. He did that. He flipped over and he put it on the wrong side, or the B side, as it were. But it turned out to be the right side because the phone lines lit up and everybody called in, and he had lots and lots of requests. And within a few weeks, it went from discovery on his radio station to number one, and then it spread all over the Bay Area. It was number one. And with that in their pocket, they went to Liberty Records in Hollywood, and they signed us for a national distribution deal.
And the song eventually hit number two in the whole national chart.
It did, yeah. But in those days, you know, the United States was very isolated. The cities were isolated from each other. We didn't have the internet. We didn't have the television. We had basic television, but it was very few channels and very, very little news. And so we really didn't know what was going on that much in other cities, and they had their own cultures and their own way of doing things. And when it came to records, they were basically released, but they didn't always hit in the same area at once. They sort of, in this case with The Mountains High, it sort of worked its way across the country gradually. It went from the West Coast, where it was a hit first, and then it spread to the Midwest and South, and then finally it took a long time for it to hit the East Coast. So finally it did, and when all that was cumulative, it made it up the Billboard charts.
I think one of the most interesting things is that when the record came out, Dick St. John and Mary Sperling were surprised to see the label on it. What happened with that?
Well, yes, Dick came to my house. First of all, this was the first thing we'd ever done, and we were 18 and 19 years old at that time. And Dick drove over to the house. He had the single in his hand to hand me, this 45 RPM vinyl disc of our song, to see it. I was going to see it for the first time. And he walked up and he handed it to me, and I looked at it, and it was this dark blue label. This was our before Liberty. This was mm-hmm. the first label, our producer's label. And it said Llama Records. And I was so excited. I looked down, and then I saw it said Dick and Dee Dee. Now, my name was Mary, and they didn't tell me or even ask me. They just made up a name. And I said, wait a minute, it says Dee Dee, who's that? And Dick said, well, I knew you'd be upset, but he said, they named you after a disc jockey's daughter in San Francisco named Tom Donahue, and her daughter's name was Deirdre. And I said, but what does that have to do with us? You know? And anyway, he just looked at me and said, oh, you'll get used to it. And of course I have, and that's been my name for all these years. I've gone by that. So we were quite surprised. So I was quite surprised to see my name had been changed.
I would be so if my name was changed as well, although if it became a huge hit, it probably wouldn't bother me too much.
Be like if tomorrow you came to work and they said, your name is Joe now.
Exactly.
Like,
as long as I had the number one show in those time slots, okay. I'll be any number, any name is that they want to sign the check to, it's fine with me. Now, I wanted to talk a little bit about your schooling and growing up, because I understand you grew up with a lot of people who were really big in the industry. In fact, one of my old buddies, Ani Wu Ginsberg, Jan Berry, and Dean Torrance from Jan and Dean and Nancy Sinatra. Tell us a little bit about that and how they reacted when all of a sudden you had a big hit.
Well, we didn't have a hit when we were in high school, so their reactions we never knew because we never saw them at that point. Mm. But when we went to high school, it was called University High School in West Los Angeles. And at that time, Palisades High wasn't built. There were a lot of schools that were built afterwards. It took up some of the population because we were a huge generation of boomers. And we hit that school, and literally there were so many kids that they had to have staggered classes where they would have to go in three different shifts throughout the day. It was just absolutely crazy how many people were there. And that was our class, basically, in the 10th grade. So. Out of that class, we had there were older kids, and some of the people that were older in 11th and 12th grades included. Let's see, we had Nancy Sinatra went there. We had Ryan O'Neal. These were actors, of course, and Nancy became a singer. We had one of the Beach Boys, Bruce Johnson, who's with them now still. As you mentioned, Jan and Dean, and they started out as Jan and Arnie, and they did have success in high school. They had their hit Jenny Lee when we were all in high school together, and that was a wake-up call for anybody that liked music and thought they could ever wanted to get into the music industry. That was the proof that, hey, if these guys, we knew these guys, we saw them every day, if these guys could do it, maybe someone else could do it. And I, at that point, I started a girls' group. We had four girls, and we used to sing in an alley before school, you know, until they'd raise their window and shout and tell us to be quiet. We were disturbing their cat or something. But... we went around. Jan was actually helpful at that time. He gave me some leads to take the girls. We didn't have anything on tape. We'd go sing live at these record companies. They must have thought, oh my goodness, look at this. Here come these three girls and four girls, and they're singing here, you know, live.
Hmm.
But when Dick and I had success, we were already a year out of high school. So we did a major tour with Jan and Dean when we both had hit records in the Midwest one time. And I've written about all this. I have a book that I've written called Vinyl Highway, and I decided to write a memoir about this whole experience of singing with Dick in the 60s, and it's really fun. A lot of people either live through the era and just love hearing about it again, and especially hearing what went on behind the music scene in that era, and then a lot of people are interested in it because they didn't live in that era, and I get a lot of emails from kids that say, oh, you know, I wish I'd been born earlier, I really missed something, and it's true, you did.
That's absolutely true.
The 60s were an amazing time to be alive, to see what was going on in this country throughout the 60s. There was so much that happened.
Civil rights movement came, and the music of the mid-60s to late and early 70s was some of the best music ever made.
That is absolutely 100% true, and I just think, you know, it was the most creative, probably the most creative time for music in 100 years, and I think ever since, quite frankly. The music of that's right, it was the mid-60s to the late 60s, and you had this diverse, because we were having such an unusual, the country at times, it went close to anarchy, we had the Vietnam War was going on, we had assassinations, but in spite of all of that, out of that came the most amazing variety of music. You'd have Simon and Garfunkel on the charts along with Jimi Hendrix. You'd have, you know, you just had the gauntlet out there and the most creative with the Beatles and the Stones and, you know, we can go on all day about the artists, but...
I just wrote an article in the local papers out here called When I Was Young, which was talking about that. And, of course, that's the title of an Animals tune as well. But, I mean, it was a completely different time. But nowadays, though, kids have, you know, the Internet and iPods and downloading and podcasts and blogs and all these things that we didn't have, and it's really changed the music business and the way kids listen to music.
Well, it's changed how people even relate to each other. I think so much of it is done electronically these days. And, of course, we didn't even have cell phones, so you can imagine a lot of the problems that happened in Vinyl Highway when I wrote about some of the tours happened because we couldn't get help when we were in trouble, or, you know, we couldn't get to pay phones, or the hotel switchboard shut down at midnight and we had to make a call at 1 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that we didn't have cell phones. That was one of the greatest things that's come along in the recent years. People might be interested in checking out the Dick and Dee Dee website. It's www.dickanddeedee.com, ANDDICKANDDEEDEE.com, and look at the vintage videos on there. Click on the video link. There's some really, really great vintage videos from different shows, Shindig, Dick Clark, and the last two are really hilarious. One of them is gone on YouTube, and it's a scopotone, which people are collecting them these days. There must be 60 or 70 scopotones floating around on the Internet, and people are actually collecting them. And I did an interview with National Public Radio on scopotone, and this lady came over, and she had a CD with about 60 scopotones on it. And I wasn't aware, Dick and I had made a scopotone, but I wasn't aware that they were, A, collectible, and, B, so many were out there. And so she showed me some of them, and the producer was just so off the wall. It was so over the top. I mean, there was one on there called, the song was called I'm Caught in the Web of Love, and they had this woman in a spider web struggling, and they had this man crawling on the ground in a lizard costume, you know. I mean, this was the kind of, you know, our scopotone was pretty strange, too. Was the producer, first of all, they had no videos in those days, so they made these things with movie cameras, and the idea was they took a jukebox, and they put a big screen on top of it, about a 24-inch screen. And the idea was you'd put your coin in, and instead of just hearing the music in a restaurant or wherever you were, you would see the act singing and performing, which became it was a precursor to videos, actually. It was the first thing like that. So they took Dick and I to a Santa Monica Pier, which is sort of a wharf where they had carnival-type things. And our song was sad. It was called Where Did All the Good Times Go? And it was about a relationship that broke up. And so we're very serious in the song. We're not smiling a lot. We're singing the song. But they kept putting us in these bizarre things. Like, they had me on one of those rocking horses to go back and forth. And they had Dick in a game arcade with it. And he had a rifle. And he was shooting at, initially, these little wooden bunnies that go by or whatever they are, you know, mm-hmm. the game arcade. But then they inserted some go-go dancers in their bikinis. They'd like to put them in as much in as they could in all these scopotones. You know, scantily clad go-go dancers. Anyway, they put these girls in, and it looks like Dick's shooting the girls. It's really bizarre, and we're getting a lot of comments on YouTube on that particular for that scopotone. But they can see that on the Dick and Dee Dee website.
Well, what we're going to do when we put this thing up on our website, it will have a link to your website. So
oh, terrific!
It's
okay.
Real easy for folks to go right from one to the other, and
oh,
you should also link this onto your site as well.
Yeah, we will. Great. Yeah.
Now, I wanted to talk a little bit about the initial success. Again, Liberty picked up the songs, but after a little while, you had a couple hits on Liberty. You guys left there. What happened?
Well, we had our whole career, we would have a hit record and then we would have a miss. We would have a hit record, we would have a miss. And it was very unusual. But what it made us do was always reassess what songs are we singing? Should we change our style? So we would change, if we had a hit with a rock song and our second one was another rock song and it wasn't a hit, we suddenly did a ballad or something. We tried to really be very versatile. But on Liberty, we'd been there a couple years and we had 3 years left of our contract. And we had a friend, Sharon Sheely. She was amazing. She'd written hundreds of songs, hit songs for hit artists, and she wound up helping her husband, Jimmy O'Neill, become. She helped create the Shindig Show for her, and her husband, Jimmy O'Neill, became the host of that in the early to mid '60s. That
mm-hmm.
show was on
big
the
music show.
Yeah. So she was getting a lot of royalties on her BMI. That was a songwriter's statement that you got as a songwriter. And she was comparing her songwriting royalties to the Mountains High and Tell Me, which were on Liberty. And she was saying that what the sales they were saying we received couldn't be right. She was saying that we must have sold more because we had a higher position on the charts than some of her songs that had sold more records allegedly, but it didn't go as high in the charts.
Mm-hmm.
And she thought we should check it out. So our managers went in and they asked Liberty about this, and Liberty suddenly, within a week, it was kind of this miraculous thing. They found 100,000 extra record sales from somewhere. I don't know. But Sharon didn't give up on this. She kept saying as time went by, yeah, they found that, but you know what? You're still not near what you should be with this accounting thing. So finally, she convinced us that we really needed to go to another label at that point, but we were signed to Liberty. So Dick decided that he would go in there, and he told me that we had to, this was very dramatic, and this was a drama. We were to go in there and look really sad and upset, and Dick was going to tell them, he made up the story, he was going to tell them that he was actually having a nervous breakdown, and he couldn't stand it anymore.
And this was, by the way, I just want to add this, that Al Bennett was the owner of Liberty, and you were meeting with him at this point.
That's right. We were meeting with the president. Actually, I think we'd only peripherally met with him one other time. We barely knew this man. And we went in there, and Dick, on the way over in the car, he was starting to shout, you know, what if we lost all of our money? What if we become homeless? What, you know, working himself into a frenzy. And mm-hmm. I was looking at him going, oh, my goodness. So we got there, and we went into his office, and Al was very cheerful and happy. Hi, kids, what can I do for you? And Dick started in. Well, he had to sit down, and I sat as far as I could, knew that I was over by the door on the sofa, as far away from the scene as I could be. Mm-hmm. And the Dick sat in a chair, sort of in front of Al, and Dick started in saying, I'm really upset, my mother's really upset, and my mother had to go in the hospital, and I'm having a nervous breakdown, we've got to get off the label. And Al tried to reason with us a little bit, but Dick was working himself up into quite a frenzy at that point. And so Al had his buzzer under his desk, a little button, and he pushed it, and some men came running in, and he said, oh, you know, Dick's a little upset. And so they were talking to him, but finally they went back out, and then Dick said, I just can't stand it anymore, and he stood up, and then Al calmed him down, and he told him to sit down, and as Dick tried to sit down, he sat, but he misjudged where his chair was, so instead of sitting down on the chair, he sat down on nothing, and he fell on the floor. And at that point, it could have gone either way. I mean, I was about to burst out laughing because it really was funny looking. But
weren't you supposed to be crying at the time?
I was supposed to be sitting there looking real sad, and mm-hmm. I was supposed to be pitching in, but I was just speechless at the scene. I couldn't say a word. I just would look shocked and horrified, basically. But when he fell on the floor, he didn't hurt himself. He fell on the carpet, but it looked so funny. He was sprawled there for a second. And I had to really, I bit my inside of my cheek, and I was pinching my hip, like, don't laugh, you know. Mm-hmm. And these men didn't know, Al didn't know whether to burst out laughing or what to do. And he went, oh, my goodness, are you all right? And Dick kind of went, you know, he got up. And he continued on. Finally, Al said, look, okay, if you're this upset about this whole thing, you really don't want to be on the label, you know, I'll be happy to give you your release. And he just said, we said a few other things, like you'll never have another hit in this town and a few things mm-hmm. like that. But he gave us our release that day. And we went out in the car, and Dick got really quiet, and he just said, He said, well, we got our release. And I said, yeah. I was kind of shocked by that whole drama. And then he just said, well, I sure hope Al's prophecy wasn't true about we'll never have another hit if we go somewhere else. But our manager signed us to Warner Brothers, and our first song out on Warner Brothers was a hit. It was Young and in Love. So from then on, we kind of took off, and that prophecy, fortunately, in our case, didn't come true. But I wrote about all this in a little more detail in Vinyl Highway. This is one of the stories that I've
written. I assume they can get that through the website as well?
Yeah, they can get it through the web, through Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, and TrafficPublishing.com.
One of the things I wanted to talk to you about, which I think is fascinating, when folks get the CD, and by the way, there's a great CD compilation from Varese Sarabande, I think it's called?
Yeah.
It's called The Best of Dick and Dee Dee. It's an excellent collection.
So that came out in the 90s. That was released, yeah.
Yeah, and it's still available, and it's a nice collection. Do you have something? Have you guys redone anything, or are you reselling it, or is this?
Well, no. Well, first, that's the only thing that they've compiled. All of our hits and some of our other songs were chosen, and they put it on the CD. I think you know Dick passed away. Do you know that?
I did not know that, no.
Yes, he did. He passed away in December of 2003. And what was so strange about that was it was an accident, which, you know, an accident can always be prevented, which is really sad. Mm. But he went up on his roof. It was in December, and I guess he was clearing out his storm drains or whatever. And, you know, I've driven by that house so many times. I look at that roof, and it was a very low one-story roof. It was, you know, I knew two people who fell from heights much higher, both of them, and one from a tree and one from a two-story building. And both of them were naturally, they had their bones broken and everything, but they didn't. Dick fell from this low roof. But he fell wrong, and he landed on his neck and head, and he went into a coma. And I guess he had really, really bad massive brain damage. And then he didn't come out of the coma, and 3 weeks later he passed away.
Ooh.
So it was really a shock. That was at the end of 2003.
Did you get to go see him before he passed?
No. His wife, Sandy, was in complete shock, and she didn't notify anybody. She was just caught up in this is-he-going-to-live-or-die thing, and then when he whether he's going to come out of the coma or not, and she didn't really notify Really, hardly anybody knew that. It was a real shock. It hit the, I learned about it because it was right before Christmas, and I live in the Los Angeles area, but I was up in the Monterey area up there for the holidays, and a friend of mine telephoned and said, "You won't believe I just got the Los Angeles Times. There's an obituary, and Dix passed away." And I just said, "What?" And I couldn't believe it. I was really saddened and really shocked. And I'd seen him a couple weeks before because we lived in the same town. And we would run into each other at the drugstore and the post office. And, you know, and we had a real good, you know, we'd always say, it was kind of like we did a little dance, sort of, not a literal dance, a verbal dance of sort of friendly but not knowing quite what to say type thing, you know, because we had dissolved the act at the end of the 60s.
But I understand that he was actually touring with his wife Sandy as Dick and Dee Dee.
He did. He started doing that. I didn't write about, I ended Vinyl Highway, the book I wrote, with the breakup of the act, and there were some other incidents that took place in the 80s and 90s that I want to write. I'm writing a second book about the 70s and what happened when I went back up and lived in Big Sur in sort of a wilderness area for a while, and all the interesting things that happened with certain recording artists up there and different things. But in any event, I may get to those stories in future times, but so I didn't really write about those things, but we had some issues throughout the years, but the good news was that it was resolved. It was resolved pretty well by the latter part of the 90s and 2000. So first few years of the 2000 before Dick passed away.
Let me ask you a question. Do you perform at all yourself?
I'm not performing professionally. I'm starting to get out with this book, and I'm doing you know, book fairs, and there is some interest in pulling it back together as far as singing, but it's difficult because I sang harmony and Dick sang lead.
Well, you need to find a new lead guy to play Dick.
That's true, but, you know, he had a 4-octave range. Dick sang, you know, he would do the low voices and he put the falsetto on, and when we sang live, he'd switch from one to the other. It's just, it's not, you know, he was an amazing talent, and people of that talent don't come along every day.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, I'm considering it at this point. I've heard from... a good friend of mine is Lou Christie, and he's out there.
I was just going to suggest Lou Christie.
Oh, well, Lou's happily ensconced doing his own.
I know, but, I mean, you guys could tour together and kind of do some stuff together as well.
You know, Lou is about one of the only people, except for maybe Frankie Valli. Lou is about the only one that really has that kind of a voice, that has that tremendous falsetto.
Yeah, that's why I was thinking about that. That's so funny.
He's a wonderful guy. We toured with him on the Dick Clark Caravan of Stars tours, and I've known Lou for years.
He's been on the show a couple of times. He's a great guy.
Oh, he has. Oh, yeah. Great. Yeah. We've been in contact recently. I haven't seen him yet, but we've been talking on the phone, and he's a great guy.
Yeah, that would be a nice combination. It would be nice if you can kind of revive the group. One thing I wanted to talk about, which I thought was fascinating, and I had no idea about this until reading about it on some research I did. You guys actually sang, you cut some stuff with the Rolling Stones. In fact, one of the cuts is on this CD, Blue Turns to Gray,
right.
Jagger at Richards composition. How did that happen?
Well, it's interesting because if you go on, there's one Rolling Stones site, if you check it out, that it lists everything they ever did, and all of a sudden you'll see one of the songs, it'll say Blue Turns to Gray, and also the song Some Things Just Stick in Your Mind, and it will say recorded with Dick and Dee Dee, and people go, what? They recorded with Dick and Dee Dee? And the way this happened was we were in London promoting, for Warner Brothers, doing a record promotion tour, and we were in London, and we did a show called Ready, Steady, Go, which was very much like Shindig type concept, and we met one of the hosts, a young person our age, was named Michael Aldred. He asked us after the show if we'd like to go see some clubs in the London area, and we were really happy to go out, and it was just when the Beatles had hit, the place was jumping. It was, you know, London was the epicenter for music for about a year of the world,
mm-hmm.
and this was happening right when we were there, and it was just so fascinating to see all this, and so we did. We went out with Michael one night to some clubs, and in one club we met, he knew Andrew Oldham, who was the Rolling Stones producer. And at that point, the Rolling Stones had just, they were just really starting to take off. I think they had Time Is On My Side, they'd had that, and I'm not sure they had Ruby Tuesday yet. They were just really starting to make it internationally. They were really big.
Mm-hmm.
And so Brian Jones was sitting there with him, and we sat down, and Brian, for younger people, was one of the early Stones that passed away in the 60s. He drowned, actually. But so Brian was there, and actually Brian founded the Stones originally, and he's the one that got Mick in the group, and he sort of was in charge of the group in the early years before they really got out of England, but that's a whole other story. But anyway, So that night, Dick looked at me and he said, he whispered to me, he said, I want to see if I can get Andrew to record us while we're here. And I thought, well, I thought to myself, well, we're leaving in about 5 days, and we have producers that we're signed to in the States. This will be really interesting how Dick works this one out. So he went over and started talking to Andrew, and I couldn't hear them because there was music going loud, but I could see Andrew's body language, and Andrew started looking at his watch, like, I got to get out of here, I got to go somewhere. So Andrew just jumped up and ran out, and Dick said to me, shouted, I'm going with Andrew, I'm gonna talk him into this, and I'll let you know what happens. And he ran out. So I wound up going back to the hotel, and I found my way back there. And the next day, Dick called me. He was all excited, and he said, Andrew says he's going to record us. I talked him into it, but he said he doesn't have time to look at material we have, and he doesn't have time to pull together musicians. But he said what he would do was he would let us record on top of Rolling Stone tracks that he wasn't going to release on the Rolling Stones that they'd done. So if we can sing in that key and if we like the songs. So Dick came over to my hotel room, and he brought a giant acetate, which was a huge record made out of vinyl. It was sort of bigger than an album, an LP was in those days. It was a big thing. And we had a little portable record player. We listened to the songs, and we wrote down the lyric on hotel stationery, and we started practicing so we could sing. Dick sang what Mick was singing, the lead voice, and I sang a harmony. And so this date was set for 4 days, just a day or two before we were about to leave to go back to L.A., and we went to Decca Records in London, and we went there, and they took us into this, Andrew took us into this huge studio, and it was dark, and we were around this little microphone in the center of it all by ourselves and kind of this dim light, and he was up in the control booth with a sound engineer, and Brian Jones was there, and Keith Richards had popped in. And I often wondered if Keith popped in just wondering why on earth Andrew was recording two people on the Rolling Stones tracks, you know, why they were taking Mick's voice off and putting our voice on. But I realized later that actually Andrew was trying to promote Keith and Mick as songwriters, just like John and Paul were promoted in the Beatles. Because actually Andrew Oldham, not too many people know this, Andrew was one of their original publicists for the Beatles. And that was sort of the clout he had, that when he found the Rolling Stones in a club when they were just completely unknown, and he signed them up. He basically could do that because he was the Beatles' publicist at that point. So he was good friends with John and Paul, and he wanted to create another writing team with Keith and Mick. So we recorded these voices. We didn't get to hear it back. Andrew quickly mixed it somehow, and we didn't hear that result of that. And he handed us this large, huge studio tape in a big box, and we said hello to everybody, and we said farewell, and we came back to America. The Warner Brothers was just in the process of releasing another single, and so they held this, and we'd already worked it out with our producers. They finally gave us permission to do this, so they let us record with Andrew this one time. So that all worked out, and finally they released Some Things Just Stick in Your Mind on as a pick of the week on Shindig, which was a big television show at that time, which we were performing on. And as we were singing it, it was really one of the first times I'd really listened closely to the record, because I believe we also did Thou Shalt Not Steal on the show earlier on. And I realized how the bright voices were sort of buried, how the brightness wasn't on that record like it was on Thou Shalt Not Steal, because I was hearing a comparison.
Mm-hmm.
And then that turned out that record was never a hit. But strangely enough, the Rolling Stones released it, Blue Turns to Gray, which was actually the B-side of the record. We were promoting it first, Something Just Stick in Your Mind, and then they later on flipped it over to see if the other side would be it, and that didn't happen either. But in the 70s, the Rolling Stones released Blue Turns to Gray on one of their albums, and they took away Dick's and My Voices and put back Mick. I don't know whether they ducked him out before they kept his voice. They probably did on another track. Anyway, so Mick's voice was back, everyone laughs. They say, it's the exact same music. I said, well, yeah, it was their track. They were playing, and they're doing backup singing, you know.
That's funny. That's a funny story.
There's a lot
of good stories on Vinyl Highway.
Yeah, and, I tell all about this in the book, and I wanted to give people a real behind-the-scenes. I was in such a unique position to see what was going on in the music industry, particularly being one of the few women that was out there. And I was young. I mean, this took place between ages 18 and 27.
Right.
So I was really, this was my coming of age, basically. Other kids were in college and, you know, settling down and starting to get married. And this was my coming of age story. So
we've had a couple of guests on the show who had similar stories, in fact, who went through a lot of stuff in the 60s, like Leslie Gore and Janice Ian, and, you know, people who were very young at the time, too.
Oh, yeah.
Even younger than you.
Yeah, and there's a new book out also. I've got to tell you, it's so fabulous. It's called Louie Louie by Dick Peterson, who was and is of the Kingsmen. And this book, my jaw dropped. Not only that, there's some stories about Dick St. John, my singing partner, that I'd never heard in my life. And I could not believe some of the things Dick did with Dick Peterson there. I was just stunned. I won't give it away, but if anyone wants to read a really great book, they can check out. You can go to the Louie Louie website, which is Dick Peterson's, the Kingsman's website, and you can check out getting that book. It's fabulous.
Yeah, maybe we'll talk with him in a future time as well.
Yeah, he's great.
Yeah. So now, folks, you can go to dickanddd.com. Dick and, is it spelled out?
Yes,
A-N-D?
It's A-N-D. It's dickanddd.com.
And you can check out the CD and the book and learn a little bit more. Just one question before we let you go. The British invasion really hit big with the Stones, the Beatles, Dave Clark Five, everybody all at once, and knocked a lot of American artists off. And in 1965, that was the last time you guys charted. Was it the British invasion that did it, or was it other things?
No, it is actually, it was really interesting because when the Beatles hit and it opened up the American artists basically stopped selling for about a year, a little over a year, and that opened the way for literally hundreds of British groups that flooded in onto the American scene. And so we, oddly enough, we managed to have, near the end of that process, we got back on board with Thou Shalt Not Steal. That actually happened a little after the British thing was dying down, so we managed to have a hit record right after that. We, like all the other American artists, and everybody was affected, even Elvis. I mean, in those days, it was people just basically stopped selling records for about a year. And that happened. It was so interesting how history and music go so hand in hand, how history creates what the people write about and then the mood of what's being written. And people write songs, and it can even affect history, too. And in this case, we just had the assassination of President Kennedy. And it was so ironic that right after that, within a month or two, the nation was still in shock and mourning. This was an earlier generation's 9/11, if you will. You know, it was a completely shocking, stunning situation that took a long time to recover from as a nation and as individuals. And right after that happened, the Beatles hit, and it was a complete. It was like a 360 turn in everyone did a 360 turn for a while, to okay, we have this is such a shocking thing's happened here. Suddenly, let's look over here, because here is a happy situation happening, and all this stuff was coming over from London suddenly, and London became, America sort of died down, and London sort of became the epicenter, as it were, for music and culture for about a year. And then America got back on its feet again, history does reflect the times, and it was a fascinating period to live. I'm so grateful that I went through it, and I'm also grateful I was seeing what was going on behind the scenes musically during that time.
Well, it was a pleasure talking to you, Dee Dee.
Well, thank you so much, Mark. I really enjoyed it.
And we'll maybe talk again sometime.
Okay, terrific.
Especially when the new one comes out, maybe, in the new book.
All right, terrific.
All right, take care.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.